this is just really a sort of getting started lecture, and is, I'm guessing, is going to be largely familiar. So I thought I would just start by giving a roadmap of the course, the review of gravitational physics. And so the idea here is to partly review the sort of general relativity and geometry, the differential geometric aspects of the topic, and then to take that forward into thinking more about the sort of physics of gravity. So it starts off being very mathematical, but then will end up being much more sort of applied. And I usually like to do topics towards the end where we look at research papers and sort of try and get a current research idea and make a lecture out of that. So certainly this week it'll be mathematics, manifolds. Today I'm going to just review the basics, and then later in the week, you know, more the standard forms, Lie derivatives, you know, curvature, etc. I've got, if I end up sort of speeding up, I've put the one of the older recorded lectures up there, the link to that to review. And Aldo and I may also just go over some of the material, the more review type material, and see if maybe we want to do a sort of flipped classroom type of approach where you look at older lectures on the material and we kind of focus on slightly different aspects in the in-person session. But sort of next week, well, I guess it'll be next week, we'll certainly in the course anyway be spending quite a lot of time on black holes in one way or another. We'll be thinking about their causal structure. We'll be thinking about thermodynamics. We'll be looking at actions in gravity and how that can both impact on, you know, on things like instantons, or just also how it fits in with having a consistent sort of a action type of approach. And I think that some of that part looks forward into, if you're interested in quantum gravity, we'll be covering some of the basics here. And then the more advanced topics, again, this is important in quantum gravity, submanifolds, walls and brains, that comes up both in string theory as well as some aspects of exotic high energy cosmology. We'll be looking at perturbation theory and gravity because that's super important. Maybe even thinking a little bit about, you know, black hole ring down. And then also one of my postdocs who will be visiting with me towards the end of the visit, he's got a lecture on analog gravity that went down very well last year. So either that will substitute for one of mine or will be an extra topic. So here the emphasis is on trying to give a little bit of a sampling, if you like, of the more research topics. I'm going to have to get some water. Okay, so just to make sure that we're on the same page, I just want to be clear about my conventions, because of course conventions can trip you up. I use the signature plus minus minus minus. If I don't, I make mistakes. I've been told that's a phenomenologist signature, but there you go. I also take, unsurprisingly, C equal to 1, but and usually H bar equal to 1. That's a sort of relativist's convention. But I tend to keep G in the main. And that is really because of having, if you're hopping between different dimensions, then what you mean by a Planck scale can change if you compactify on large extra dimensions. So my Einstein equations are in that set of conventions are written there. And T00 is positive for me. Just another note of notation, A, B, C, etc., small, lowercase, Roman, are space-time indices, but not necessarily in a coordinate basis. If I write mu nu, then that will be a coordinate basis usually. I, J typically are spatial indices, but not always. They're sort of essentially some other index noting set. And then capitals, Roman indices, are submanifold indices. So I try usually to, don't try, it's just usually those are tend to mean very specific things. So on to actual revision. So, I mean, you will have seen this to some extent, although, again, since I'm not totally sure, I'm just going to put us all on the same page. And really, manifolds are a way of making mathematically precise a lot of what we know intuitively about spaces. So all we can ever say as individuals is what things look like around us. And around us, things look pretty much like Euclidean geometry, at least from a spatial perspective. And so when we want to try and generalize the idea of that Cartesian space to something much more complex, the mathematician's way of doing that is to say, well, you know, let us build up these overlapping local pictures. And so this leads us to the concept of the manifold as being a collection of what are called charts. And these charts are little open sets which have a map in them to flat n-dimensional space. So that's sort of embodied by this picture here, where on the left we've got our manifold, which is some, you know, curved object. And on the right we have our Minkowski space. I'm calling it Minkowski because, you know, we're doing gravity, so we'll have one time. But in general, it's an R to the N. And so each of these little circles on the left is meant to represent that open neighborhood or open set UI, and it goes maps onto some open set in R to the N. So here I've denoted those maps as X mu and X prime mu, but in, you know, in essence, what these are saying these are the labels. So every little point inside that upper open set has a label X, Y, Z, T, for example, if N were 4. And then to get what, you know, we in physics, we want to talk about dynamics, we want to talk about fields, particles, and so we need to have a concept of differentiability typically. And so therefore, we ask that whenever these charts overlap, that on the overlap, the transformation between the two different maps or two different sets of coordinates is infinitely differentiable. So that is, if you look at that annotation below, the C infinity manifold, that is what the infinity stands for, infinitely differentiable. Now, mathematicians don't necessarily insist on things being infinitely differentiable. You can have C2, C3 or whatever, where the number denotes how many times you can differentiate the map. But because I guess implicitly in physics, we often want to have things being analytic or infinitely differentiable, then we will, just to be definite, I'm going to assume this infinite differentiability. So that is our C infinity manifold. Our set of charts is called the atlas. And then the way that we build up our picture of M, our geometry, is that we transport structure from the right-hand side in our flat Rn, and we sort of export it, we lift it back up to the manifold, And so this is, it's this correspondence between these two pictures that builds our differential geometry up. So the first thing, the simplest thing that we can paint on our manifold is a function, and it's a really obvious thing. A function is a map from the manifold into the reals, and it is, that is locally differentiable, infinitely differentiable, that's C infinity, in all of the charts. So here we have a point in our manifold on that picture. It's our F maps it down to a number on the real line, whereas we could also take that same point, take its coordinates in the R to the N on the right, that's the X mu, and then we ask that the mapping, so we have all, we have a neighborhood of our point P, which maps to a neighborhood of the image X mu, and then we say that the map from that's induced by this F gives us an F of X mu, and that that is C infinity. So that's our set of functions, and the set of infinitely differentiable functions is denoted as this C infinity of M. So those are our functions, and that's, if you like, the sort of basic structure that we have on the manifold. We then sort of carry on and we say, well, what else can we sort of think about on our manifold? Well, we can think about curves. So once again, we're going to be thinking about what is this C infinity curve. So our curve is a map, here we denote gamma, which is a map from, now in the other direction, we take a portion of the real line, here denoted by this interval A to B. Sorry, can I just check you can see my cursor here?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. So you've got this interval, A, B, on the real line, and to each point on the interval, you denote some point in the manifold, and that defines this one-dimensional curve. You can then map that onto the image in R to the N, and by doing so, you now induce a map from this segment of the real line into R to the N. And once you're living in R to the N, you know exactly how to do differentiation, and the requirement for a C infinity curve is that this image, X mu of T, is infinitely differentiable. So again, we're, although we're sort of hopping via the manifold, we're using the structure that we know in R to the N to sort of define what's going on in our manifold. So an example of some curves, a very physical one, is the world line of an observer. So that's what we're often doing most in GR. We've got some world line, we're looking at geodesics or, you know, light rays, and we're sort of asking questions about that. So that's a clear example of a curve. It's some set of coordinates as a function of some time parameter. But of course, we could just have curves in real space. So a simple example is the curve in in two-dimensional Euclidean space, which is a circle where we map T onto cos T, sine T. And so just a point to note is the curve is actually not just the circle, but it's the circle together with this parameterization cos sine. So for example, if I put cos 2T sine 2T, it would give exactly the same image on the plane, but it would be a different curve. Same path, different curve, because the parameterization would be different. So that's just a sort of nitpicky point, you know, about the difference here. And the reason that's important will become apparent when we define vectors, because a vector is then going to be defined as a linear operator. So we define it in a sort of mathematical way, but visually, what we think about it as being is a tangent to a curve. And if it's a tangent to a curve, if we zoom across the curve twice as fast, then we expect our tangent vector to be twice as long, our speed, if you like, doubles. And so the way we define this mathematically is we say it's a map from the space of functions to the space of functions. And we say that f goes to df by dt at a particular point p for every single function in C infinity of m. So it's not so much that for an individual f, f goes to f dot, but it's the fact that it's this operator d by dt such that for every single function, f maps to df by dt at that point p. So in essence, we're saying that, you know, here we've got our f of t is, first of all, we take the image gamma of t, which lifts us up to the manifold. That then gives us an f of t because we just take the value of the function f at all points on that curve. So that is the real function, our f of composed with gamma of t. So that's what we mean by df dt. So we can write this as boldface t, underlined t, but it'll also, you'll see it written as d by dt. That's like our operator, d by dt. So these operators actually form a vector space at any particular point, which we call the tangent space, tp of m. So just sort of to check, why does it form a vector space? So what are the axioms of a vector space? Well, we know that it's got to be an abelian space under addition. So, and it's also, we've got a rescaling. So we have the fact that, we can also sort of multiply our vectors by a number. So if I have a path, which is the set of points of gamma, I can define a whole family of curves, gamma sub lambda of t, by saying instead of taking gamma of t, I take gamma of t on lambda. And what what that will then do is it will rescale my tangent vector and send t going to lambda t. So if this sort of tells us that that my tangent curve, if I traverse my path at a different rate, I rescale my tangent vector. So that gives me a multiplication by a real number. And then if I want to do addition of my vectors near the point P, what I can do is I can sort of go over to my local chart, my local Rn, and then I've got two curves which are intersecting at P, and locally they've got a tangent vector T and a tangent vector S, say. And so within that chart, what I do is I sort of construct a composite curve by saying that near P, I construct an X3, which is just X1 plus an X2. And so that's my gamma 1 plus gamma 2, which is obviously only defined in a neighborhood, but that's okay, because I actually only ultimately want to define things at P. And so my T plus S as the linear map is my F goes to df by dt along gamma 1 and df by ds along gamma 2. But I mean that, you know, I guess what I should have said is that in essence, I should have put perhaps a new variable here called u, because my x3 is x1 of u and x2 of u. So that's perhaps not notationally the best thing to have done, but hopefully it's reasonably obvious what I'm meaning here. So this gives me a way of combining vectors. So I can add vectors and I can scale vectors. And that's really all I need for a vector space. And of course, that's got to be true for every single f in C infinity of m. So that tells me how to construct a tangent space. And then just for completeness, the tangent bundle is just the set of all tangent spaces. So this TP of M is a flat vector space, and it's distinct from the manifold because it is, you know, we've constructed it by taking tangent vectors at a particular point, and those tangent vectors are not lying in the manifold, they're a map from sort of the function space on the manifold. So it's only defined at P. And I think that the easiest way to visualize this is to think of the sphere. So if you look at a point on the sphere, let's say the North Pole, and take tangents to curves running through the North Pole, these tangents will all sit in a plane that touches the sphere at the North Pole. So this plane, it's an infinite two-dimensional plane, that's TP of M, but our sphere is, of course, a compact manifold. So that's a really very different space. But locally, they both kind of look the same, just very, very small neighborhood of the North Pole. And so the tangent bundle of the sphere is just a set of these planes for each point on the sphere. So I'm just going to pause for a couple of seconds to see if there are any questions. It's all just reasonably familiar. Okay, bless you then. Just got a sneeze instead of a question. Okay. Covectors, right. So we're building up structure here. We've got our vectors. We've got those as a map from C infinity of M to C infinity of M. And now we want to think about what else do we have? At the moment, we haven't got, we're still just building structure. We don't have our metric, which we kind of know about because we've already met GR. So how do we get numbers out of vectors? So this is done with a covector. So we define these via maps from the tangent space to the reals. And so although this is a little bit dodgy mathematically, I like to think of this as the dot product in a way, but you have to be a bit careful. Okay, so you'll see that vectors I've denoted with Latin alphabet, covectors I'll often denote with Greek alphabet. So omega, a covector, is a map from the tangent space into the reals, and you denote it as V goes to omega of V, or sometimes the Brar-Kep notation is used, that makes more sense, I guess, when you're doing quantum Hilbert spaces. So the set of these omegas also forms a vector space at P, and we call this the cotangent space or the dual vector space. And so you can, again, essentially you get the rescaling of omega by sort of thinking about its action on the vector. So we denote this as TP star of M, the dual space. And again, we get a dual cotangent bundle of the manifold just by collecting all of the cotangent spaces at the different points on the manifold. Now, we've said that we've got both the vector space and the covector space, our vector spaces. Therefore, we can choose bases. And what we usually do when we're doing calculations in GR is that we choose the coordinate basis. So just to see how how these are constructed, remember we said that TF was DF by DT at a point. Well, what we could do is, again, we can kind of take that object and take it over to the sort of local Rn, and by using that coordinate chart, the x mu, And we just basically use the chain rule. We've got our coordinates we can think of as as functions, because, you know, each of those are just individual labels for a particular point. And then when we look at F in our local chart, then we have our function. We can differentiate that with respect to each of the coordinate directions. So, for example, looking at the y coordinate function, we can sort of imagine that as, well, I can see how much f is changing along y, and I can see how y is changing along my curve, and looking at that at the point P. And so here, what you kind of see is that df by dx mu is like taking the derivatives of x along each of the coordinate directions, and then you have this object dx mu by dt. And so here, we d by dx mu is like our coordinate basis vector, and then dx mu by dt is like the components of a vector. So here we've got our vector on the left, which is the geometric object, and on the right-hand side, we could write those dx mu by dt as t mu. And so our d by dx mu, this was our basis vector, this is an operator, but the t mu are the components or set of scalars. So this, I'm sorry, I'm going to labor this point a little bit, because a lot of what we do when we do the physics of manifolds is done in a sort of rather old-fashioned notation from the mathematician's perspective. And so I'm just trying to kind of be clear about, you know, the way mathematicians might label something compared to the way that we as practitioners are going to use them. And so similarly, for covectors, we have a coordinate basis, which is, is dx mu. So these are our basis covectors, and the omega mu are the components. So if we try then to put this together, you will see that we effectively get the dot products. And I don't think I put that in the slide. Okay, so that's our coordinate basis. But in general, we want to use non-coordinate bases. And this is particularly relevant if we're thinking about supergravity, because if we want to start defining spinners on a manifold, then our gamma matrices are defined with respect to a sort of a standard Minkowski, an orthonormal type of metric. And so we usually want to be able to define our spinners in this orthonormal basis. So this is why we sort of in general have our set of basis vectors denoted, sorry, for some reason I'm managing to get my words muddled today, denoted by some arbitrary basis EA. And so our arbitrary basis will have a set of components which are labeled by this mu in our coordinate basis. So what you will often see in the literature are these objects on the right-hand side, the EA mus, and these are called Feuerbein in four dimensions, or Feuerbein in arbitrary dimensions. And this is, if you like, where a lot of the guts of the structure of the manifold can lie when you're dealing with a general curved space. So in practice, in this course, we'll be looking at really just two types of basis, one of which will be the coordinate basis, and the other one, which is only relevant once we have a metric, will be the orthonormal basis, where we choose our vectors to be unit in length. So in other words, G, our metric, has components eta AB in that basis. So I'm just going to pause again because I think I'm racing through these. Any questions? Any sneezes? No. Okay. So I just also, when I said a couple of slides earlier about, you know, the trying to labour the point about the mathematical notation versus our physics notation, this is encapsulated by Penrose in what he called the abstract index notation. And really what he was trying to do was to be very clear and specific about the different practice of the way physicists use the tools of differential geometry and the way an actual differential geometer would approach differential geometry. So we, as physicists, often write T mu to mean a vector. And so our covariant derivative, for example, in this middle formula, this is what we would write down. We would say, okay, grad mu T mu is the partial derivative plus the connection components, and that's what we would write. But that is not the way that, you know, that would look a very strange thing to a mathematician, because strictly the T mu's are the components of the vector, and so they're scalars. So a covariant derivative acting on a scalar is just the partial derivative. And how do we kind of reconcile this? Well, the vector is the geometric object, the T, this boldface T. And so the actual geometric expression is the covariant derivative acting on the geometric T, which is the covariant derivative of the components of T contracted with the basis vectors. And then by the Leibniz rule, we have that will be the covariant derivative acting on the components times the basis vectors plus the components times the derivative of the basis vectors. The former just are the partial derivatives of the scalar that I was saying, and the latter is where you pick up the connection. So in essence, this up here is our shorthand way of taking this geometric derivative. And the reason we do this thing is because we're actually working and trying to calculate things about the manifold, we get our, you know, we have to do a lot more in detail algebraic calculations. And if we try to stick to this geometric notation, it would just become unwieldy. Whereas mathematicians are much more interested in sort of abstract properties or sort of properties that are, you know, common over a whole class of different spaces. And so therefore it's much more structural as opposed to detailed. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of make that point because it is a different way of different language for the same thing. So that is our abstract index notation. So again, just be careful. For the first bit of the course, we'll be sticking more with the mathematical sort of approach. But once we actually have to sort of actually find some answers and solve problems, we'll revert to the standard physicist approach of abstract index notation. So that was just a health warning. And then returning to some of the old-fashioned ways of thinking about vectors, notice that under a change of coordinates, the transformation between one basis and another basis is just the coordinate transformation here, the dx prime by dx. And so the point about the tangent vector, or indeed any geometric object, is that because it's something geometric, it doesn't care about those charts. It doesn't care about which chart it lives in. It's the same object. And so T cannot change if you change coordinates. And so here, our T mu d by dx mu is going to go to T mu times that transformation matrix times d by dx prime. And so this tells us how the components of a vector transform under a coordinate transformation. They transform, if you like, contravariantly, sort of against the dx prime by dx. So going from x to x prime, they transform as dx prime by dx. That's the contravariant vector. So that used to be how vectors were defined. They were defined via their transformation rules under a coordinate transformation. But that's not really a geometric way of expressing them. It doesn't sort of give you a picture of what they're doing. But it was just, you know, again, a way of how it was done by indices. And of course, vectors and covectors transform in the opposite way. And so covectors transform. If you go from x to x prime, then they go by dx prime. And so, of course, this gives you the classic issue of how to do differentiation on manifolds, because if you take dt by dx, if you just try partial differentiation and do a coordinate transformation, then transforming the d by dx nu, you get dx prime by dx, d by dx prime, nu prime. And the t itself, we know how that transforms. It's dx by dx prime times t prime. And so what you get is the first bit, which is what you would expect in terms of a covariant and a contravariant index. But then you get this extra piece, which you don't want, which is the second derivative of the coordinate transformation. So this is often used as a motivation for developing the covariant derivative. But, you know, also, I think what I'm going to sort of use this as is just a commentary in terms of how you might be able to do a geometric differentiation. Because if you notice, the bit by which this doesn't work is symmetric under the interchange of this mu prime and mu prime index. So what this sort of gives you as a clue is that apart from the connection, there's a chance that you can develop a geometric definition of derivatives if somehow there's a sense of anti-symmetry involved. So the first derivative that we will come across is the Lie bracket, or the Lie derivative. Here we're just doing it as a Lie bracket, which is looking at the commutator of two vectors. So remember that the vectors are linear map from functions to functions. So you start with a function, then you get a function. So you can apply a second vector operator to that. So that means that you can take uv acting on f, which is u act u of v of f, and then subtract v of u of f. So here, u, the operator u is u mu d by dx mu, similarly v, that should be a nu, and then you just subtract off the reverse. And so what you see is that the sort of second order derivatives on F cancel out because of the symmetry of the partial derivatives. And so what you end up with is just U dV nu by dx minus V du nu by dx acting on dF by dx. And so what this tells you is that these are the components of a vector, which we call the commutator or the Lie bracket of u and v. And so if you look at what happens under a coordinate transformation, you kind of will see that this object here, the UdV by dmu minus VdU, is actually invariant. Those the anti-symmetry kills the this second derivative. So the this is a if you like a sort of way in which we can take a derivative of two vectors, but that is actually generalizable to more, you know, more arbitrary geometric objects. Now, I realize I've got to the end of my slide, so I must have absolutely raced through that. So please, questions, because this is, I've finished the material, at least I've got slides for.